Hi, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate. And as everybody knows, this show is coming to you in extraordinary times. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear two pieces by Bob Avakian, or BA, a revolutionary leader, author, and architect of the new communism. Last week, I played a piece on the oppression of black people and other people of color from the speech, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. This time, we're going to hear two more selections from that section, which is called The Five Stops. We'll hear the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants and male supremacy stitched together with capitalism. Before that, I'm bringing you an interview with Trevor Timm. Now, Trevor Timm is the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, and they have been documenting an unprecedented wave of attacks on reporters during the protests of the murder of George Floyd. And opening the show up, we'll be talking with Coco Das from the editorial board of Refuse Fascism. George Floyd was torturously murdered in plain sight by Minneapolis cops as onlookers begged them to stop. In Georgia, Ahmaud Arbery, a black jogger, was murdered by white vigilantes on video. In Louisville, police stormed in and murdered Breonna Taylor in her own home. She was not a suspect in any crime. In Minneapolis, thousands have taken to the streets in grief and anger and were met with more brutality. Tear-gassed, beaten, corralled, and condemned as rioters. Enough is enough. No more white supremacist murder by police and armed vigilantes. Refuse Fascism stands with everyone fighting for justice for George Floyd. This is what we're going to be talking about today with Coco Das, who is part of the editorial board of RefuseFascism.org and a writer for RefuseFascism.org. All right, well, let's jump into this. You know, one thing that's happened over the last few weeks is that a lot of people have really, and this is not a razor sharp, suddenly figuring out something that nobody else has seen, but it's actually very important in terms of what's happening in the society, what's going on in the society right now. And there's been a real turn among a very important grouping of people who are refusing to just sit there and allow themselves and other people to be tortured and murdered by this system. Now, Refuse Fascism has been very active in this, but why don't you explain to people, what is Refuse Fascism? Who and what is it?
Yeah, so Refuse Fascism is an organization and a movement comprised of people coming from different backgrounds, different perspectives, who are united under the understanding that the Trump-Pence regime poses a catastrophic danger to humanity. This is a fascist regime with its finger on the nuclear trigger. And even up to this point, for three years, we have seen this regime denying science, denying climate change, putting immigrants into concentration camps, turning ICE into a American Gestapo, taking away women's rights to birth control, filling the federal courts and the Supreme Court with pro-fascist judges that will overturn these rights for women and LGBT people. And our strategy, we have said from the beginning, shortly after the election, but we have always said that there is no savior from above. This will not be resolved through the normal channels of elections or checks and balances. Those things will be shredded. And we have seen over 3.5 years that the rule of law has been shredded. The checks and balances have been shredded. This is a regime that lies and has no shame, actually, in what they do. The only way to resolve this is for the millions of people who hate this, who absolutely wake up with gut-wrenching disgust at what this regime is doing, for us to take to the streets and sustain nonviolent protests demanding that the regime must go. And all over the world, we've seen that this is a way that regime, even highly entrenched regimes, cannot withstand that kind of political crisis of people in the streets day in, day out. And you're seeing that now play out. I mean, this is an extraordinary moment, which you referred to, that for so long, people have waited for these normal channels. They've been the opposition that was needed when we found out there was family separation. We found out there were concentration camps swelling. When we found out that Trump told the military to shoot or to defy border laws, the opposition was nowhere near what it needed to be. It was not commensurate with the danger that we faced. But now suddenly something is broken open. there are tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, in the streets day after day, and they are not backing down. They have withstood rubber bullets, tear gas, in the face of terrible repression. They have come out again and again in response to George Floyd, but also to say enough, no more police murder of Black people, no more white supremacy normalized, you know, from the streets all the way up to the White House. And the sentiment that Trump is putting gasoline on this crisis is very, very, very strong. And this, the hatred of this white supremacy, the hatred of these police murders is also wrapped up with the hatred of this regime, which then needs to actually go all the way toward driving the regime out of power.
Yeah, it's really important what you're saying. You know, one of the things I was thinking of was that, you know, history's shown that fascism has to be stopped before it becomes too late. And one of the things that I was always getting more and more concerned about was to watch the way that Trump was able to roll through all of this stuff and just laying down his horse manure of not to insult horses, but but laying it down across all of us. And we're wallowing in it. We're walking through it. And then all of a sudden, you know, nobody's happy, but there's actually all of a sudden something breaks loose. And I thought that was really important to dig into because it's okay. All right. So let me just say this.
You were making a very profound point. Yeah.
Okay. So go ahead and answer it.
Well, I think what you were talking about was that fascism has to be stopped before it's too late. And I think this is something that people really do need to confront, that, you know, fascism advances in stages. The death camps in Nazi Germany didn't come till the 40s, but in 1933, the seeds of that were there. And Hitler was a fascist regime from the beginning. And it's the same is true now. You know, fascism is a genocidal ideology. Group after group is demonized, and dissent is piece by piece criminalized. Look at how many different groups this regime has gone after: Latino immigrants, LGBT people, women who are liberated, journalists, you know, scientists. And the whole concept of truth, the very idea of truth and objective reality, is bludgeoned. And it's not just a pendulum swing. It is actually a qualitative change in how society is governed. And these fascists, these who have cohered around Trump and Pence, see this as their last chance. And I think right now they see this as a chance, their last chance, that is in danger of slipping away from them if they don't at some point bring down the hammer. And in this situation, where now people have gotten into the ring, so to speak, and I'm talking metaphorically, where, you know, people are standing up. If this regime is able to remain in power and call out their shock troops, which Trump is doing, call out the military, call out these, you know, white supremacists in the police force. Don't forget that Trump said, "I have the police, military, and bikers for Trump." Well, I mean, there's splits in the military we can see right now, but the divisions at the top are very sharp, and they're coming up against the most opposition they've had. What they do in response is going to actually determine whether we have a future for humanity and the planet, and what we do in response. I mean, there's just a lot at play here, but they are not going to back down easily. They're not going to just go away. They need to actually suppress these protests and suppress this opposition. And if they are able to do that, if Trump is able to get through this crisis, that is going to mean horrible things for humanity. The consequences are going to be very dire. It's not going to just go back to normal. It's actually going to be worse, because they will be going all out for revenge. So this is why now is a moment to seize, where we have to continue to stay in the streets. And as part of every struggle for justice, and this struggle for justice for George Floyd, we also need to bring the demand, Trump Pence out now.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with Coco Das from the editorial board of Refuse Fascism. Yeah, that's actually what I was going to ask you. And you know, because I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, there's a whole lot out there that's, you know, there's, look, there's the, actually, when you think about it, there's humanity is at stake. and you know, the planet, humanity. It's just, it's, you know, and I know it sounds a little like sort of, oh yeah, the planet and the humanity, you know. No, but the fact is, it's a really serious thing that we're facing with, and it's something that we haven't really faced in a very, I don't think we've ever actually faced this kind of situation where the planet itself could disappear, you know, and if it doesn't disappear, the terrible suffering that so many people will go through one way or another is really, really just incredibly, it's mind-blowing. And it really compels people to actually start to, you know, I think in a certain way, not just to recognize history, but to recognize which direction history is moving in and recognize what's actually necessary for today. And I was wondering about that in relation to how Refuse Fascism has been, you know, when it goes out to people, what it's been doing. What's it look like in terms of people coming forward?
Well, last Saturday we were in D.C. and in cities all over the country, in L.A., Chicago, Detroit, Boston. And we were bringing out to the people who are hungering for justice, who are fighting for justice right now, and who really do want this nightmare of this regime to end, but don't necessarily know what is the dynamic that can actually make that happen. So we were out in D.C. bringing four demands: no more police murder of black people, no fascist police state, no fascist military war on the people, Trump Pence out now. And there was a tremendous response to what we were bringing. And also, I should say that Sansara Taylor, one of our co-initiators, and Carl Dix, one of our co-initiators, was in Minneapolis and bringing this message to all the outpouring of youth and people in Minneapolis in support of George Floyd. So we were bringing this all over the country, that we need to keep going, that we have begun, and we are the force that can stop this regime, and Trump and his whole regime must go now. And so you can see, actually, I would recommend that people go to our website, refusefascism.org, and there's a feature called Sights and Sounds, and it shows some of the video, and very inspiring video, and people chanting Trump Pence out now, you know, hundreds of people. And if you imagine that reverberating from coast to coast, very quickly it could force this regime out of power. Now, this Sunday is Trump's birthday, and we are posing the question, what is a fitting way to celebrate in air quotes, celebrate Trump's birthday? What would actually be a gift to the people of the world on Trump's birthday? And what we are bringing again is, we're going back to DC, we're going to be in the streets across the country again, and we're going to be bringing these four demands again, and really elevating this movement to the next level, where we can actually prepare people to win this demand and to actually lift the boots of this regime off of our backs.
Now, tell me this, and there's only a couple more questions here, but tell me this, because I think it's really important to follow up on what you've just been saying. I mean, there's a whole strategy that's been developed around this that I think has been very important in terms of Refuse Fascism has really thought about it and put things into motion that actually will be part and parcel of, a very important part and parcel of taking on the Trump regime and all the fascists that are around them. You know, and you know, basically, at the same time as I know all that abstractly, I also think that there's a thing that people need to know. And people ask me this all the time. They're saying, so what are we charged to do right now? What are we charged with right now? And what difference is it going to make if we do stand up and do this?
We're charged with acting on our courage, acting with conviction, acting with courage to stop a catastrophe for humanity. We have a statement of conscience up on the website, which starts with this, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but there are times in history where people must act with extraordinary courage and conviction. And this is one of those times. You were talking about, you know, the future of the planet is on the line, and that this is absolutely true. Trump is more dangerous than Hitler. Hitler didn't have nukes. Hitler wasn't, you know, as dangerous as he was. He was not in power at a time when the climate crisis is actually creating a situation where millions of people are going to be displaced through climate change. Millions of others are displaced through these wars that come out of this situation with the planet. And it really is not an exaggeration to say that the future of humanity and the planet is on the line, and it is up to us. We are the people the majority of people in this country who actually can make a difference to people all over the world by standing up. Look at how these, you know, just these 2 weeks, more than 2 weeks of protests has inspired people all over the world to stand up. And if we can actually keep going and actually drive out this regime that's also inspiring other fascists all over the world, then we can actually start to imagine a future where people can thrive, where we can all thrive, where we can actually really work towards a just society. So our responsibility right now, to put it simply, is to stay in the streets, acting nonviolently, protesting nonviolently, but not stopping until this regime is driven out of power.
So an uprising has begun, huh? Very good, actually.
Yes.
It makes my heart sing. There you go.
And, all right. You know, one thing we have said, too, is that Trump-Pence regime, in response to this, is escalating its threats against protesters. And what we are calling for is an escalation of nonviolent resistance in this fight for justice.
That's what I was just going to ask you. I want you to give people a sense of what that means, because there's a lot of people, including people who have read different pieces from you and others, and you know, that, and actually say, well, what does this actually mean in terms of what you're calling for people to do? And I wanted that, and then also just the thing about how can people get in touch with you? What can they be looking forward to in this next period?
Well, I think we see a glimpse of what it looks like, where, you know, every bit of repression that came down, the police throwing tear gas, shooting rubber bullets, Trump calling out the military, that brutal scene outside the Rose Garden where all the federal forces were unleashed to clear out a peaceful protest. Yet the whole world was watching, and the next day more people came out. And, you know, that is actually kind of it's a simple formula where, and it, you know, we've never said this is going to be an easy road, and there will be more repression, and there will be more, you know, there will be, you know, cars trying to run over protesters, all kinds of things. But we cannot waver in what's at stake and what we need to do in order to actually prevent this regime from consolidating power. And what you can do right away is donate, because we have to get lots and lots and lots of materials out there. We have all of our materials that we're going to be taking out this weekend, and we need funds to get people to DC to get these materials there. And join us if you can be in DC. Come to Lafayette Park at 4 p.m. or you can go to refusefascism.org and find out where other people are going to be and at what time. And spread the word about us on social media. We have lots of really good videos and graphics building up for this weekend's actions around Trump's birthday.
One last thing. So tell people again, what is going to be happening this weekend?
So this weekend, we are going to give Trump a birthday he will never forget and give the world a reason to rejoice, because we're going to be raising the demand, filling the streets, calling on thousands of people, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, to get into the streets and raise this demand, Trump Pence out now, and let that resonate and reverberate from all across the country. And we'll be in Lafayette Park in D.C. at 4 p.m. and in other cities and towns across the country. And you can find that out at refusefascism.org.
So again, if people go to refusefascism.org, they'll be able to find out all they ever wanted to know about in relation to all this.
Yes, and also on all our platforms on social media, it's at refusefascism.
All right, great. All right, Coco, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael. It was good to be here.
All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Coco Das of the editorial board of Refuse Fascism. Before we get into my interview with Trevor Tim, I want you to hear a short clip.
I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
Yes, that was Trump, the bloated bag of fascist feces, calling the press the enemies of the people and fake news. Now we are seeing the results of Trump's campaign against the media, as hundreds of reporters have been arrested, beaten, shot with rubber bullets, and more, all of which has been carefully documented by the Freedom of the Press Foundation. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Trevor Timm. Trevor is the executive director of Freedom of the Press Foundation. He is also the co-founder of the Stand With Reality campaign, which is raising money for Winner's legal defense and awareness about the Espionage Act's use against the sources of journalists. Trevor, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back. Yeah. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, let's jump into this because I got a ton of stuff and I want you to not hold back in what you've got to say around this because it's extremely important. Let's just start off with a couple of questions. And I want, this one is actually going to be tied into what I just mentioned, what you're doing, your the Freedom of the Press Foundation and all that. So let's just start off with a couple of questions there. In the intro, I mentioned that you are the co-founder of the Stand With Reality campaign. What is this campaign?
Well, Reality Winner is a whistleblower who came forward about 2 or 3 years ago now. This was early in the Trump administration. She went to The Intercept and allegedly leaked a document, an NSA document that described how hackers from Russia were attempting to infiltrate voter infrastructure in the United States. This is kind of at the height of the whole Russia scandal with the Trump administration. And despite the fact that this was on the front pages of the newspaper virtually every day, Reality Winner, her case kind of got forgotten about. She was charged under the Espionage Act, you know, a law that was originally meant for spies, despite the fact that she was trying to alert the American public about an issue of public interest. And she was sentenced to 5 years in prison for doing this. And a lot of the information that she released to the public was actually information that was public to begin with. It was eventually released by the Mueller administration. And despite the fact that this scandal was on the front pages of newspapers every day, there was a huge injustice served where her case was forgotten about and she was essentially stashed away in prison for years. And we wanted to make sure that the public really heard about her case. And it's a stark example of how the federal government throughout the past 2 or 3 administrations for the past decade has used this Espionage Act as a tool to stifle transparency within government, to chill journalism and to prosecute brave whistleblowers.
Yeah, extremely important. You know, it's amazing because I had not heard of her at all before seeing what you had written about her. And I was kind of curious about this because it does play into a lot about what's actually the call that's being put out to journalists in a certain sense to act a certain way in following with the sort of the high standing that people have expected over the years. And there's been, you know, granted, there's been ups and downs, but people have a sense of we need people like her to actually stand up and talk about what's true. And today we need it even more importantly, we need it, you know, across the board for journalists to be able to tell the truth, but want to tell the truth at the same time. So in speaking about this and all the stuff that's covering the recent police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, you've actually said, and I thought this was very important, you said that as they are doing their investigation, journalists have come under severe attacks by the Minneapolis police, an attack so large that it's hard to fathom. It's unprecedented in size and scale. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, the last 2 weeks, I think, have been shocking for everybody who has been paying attention to these protests. And thankfully, more people are paying attention than ever. It's really turned into an unprecedented nationwide movement. And, you know, part of the reason that so many people know about it now is because journalists have been on the streets recording the police violence against all of these protesters. But what has happened is that the police have also turned their weapons and their brutality on journalists who are documenting all of these events. And the amount of violence against journalists, like you just quoted, is staggering. So just to give you an example, at the Freedom of the Press Foundation, we have a project called the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, and we actually systematically track press freedom violations in the U.S. every year. And so last year, we documented about 150 total press freedom violations. So this can include journalists arrested, assaulted, subpoenaed, denied public access to an event. And we thought at the time that 150 was quite high. It was actually the most we had tracked in the 3 years we've been doing this. But in just the last 2 weeks, we are investigating over 400 press freedom violations related to the George Floyd protests. And the vast, vast majority of these have been conducted by police. So just in the last 2 weeks or 15 or 16 days, almost 60 reporters have been arrested. Well over 50 have been physically assaulted by police officers. Another 50 have been tear gassed, another 30 have been pepper sprayed, and a staggering 87, at least 87, have been shot with rubber bullets or other projectiles. And in many cases, this has happened on live national television, where reporters from CNN or MSNBC or local affiliates are standing off to the side with cameras and press passes and microphones, and police with riot gear turn and target them. So it has been quite horrifying in a number of ways. And it's really opened people's eyes to the state of police aggression in this country.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to talk with you about is this. There are some attempts, you make this point, you say that there are some attempts to label this a situation fueled by both police and protesters alike. And that's something that's very common, I think. It actually carries a lot of weight in the society with people say, well, you know, both sides are to blame. You know, you can't really speak about one versus the other, but there's actually, you know, maybe you could say I like this person better, I like that person better. But basically, people tend to ignore, or what actually more than people tend to ignore, the system actually puts out a thing that says that this is a situation that's fueled by both police and protesters alike. And you argue against that pretty strongly, I think. You say that this is incorrect, that it's primarily a straight-up attack by the police on journalists.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think the both sides issue is a severe problem sometimes when we see reporting like this. Because, you know, people will see violence against journalists, and then there's common phrases that writers use that's, you know, saying quite literally, journalists are being attacked by police and protesters alike. Now, it's true, there have been a few isolated incidents, and some of them quite serious, of non-police officers, whether they're protesters or people attending protests that are trying to stir up trouble, attack journalists. But we took a look at our data that we collect, and we collect the most comprehensive data in the country on this, and found that the overwhelming majority of violence against journalists at these protests have been happening by police officers. So when you look at physical assaults, cops are responsible for the vast majority of them. You know, obviously, private citizens aren't arresting journalists either, and there's been 60 of those by the police. And the amount of weapons that police have fired at journalists during these protests is just staggering. You know, I was mentioning some statistics before, but if you add up all of the tear gassings, pepper sprayings, and firing of projectiles at journalists, it reaches well over 100 and close to 200. 200 instances over 65 cities in the country, affecting well over 30 states. So this is a nationwide issue. Certainly the most that we've seen have come from Minneapolis, but there's a dozen states that have had over 10 or more of these instances. And so, you know, we found that more than 83% of the attacks on journalists during these protests have come directly from the police. And, to kind of paint this broad brush that attacks are happening by police and protesters alike, I think is a bit misleading, because it's clear from our data that the police are the true aggressors here.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about, too, as you were speaking, is that this point about labeling, labeling the situation fueled by both police and protesters alike, and you're making this argument, and it's really important that people understand that it is primarily straight up an attack by the police on the journalists that's going on here. And I think there's this sort of equivocation that people get, where it's like, well, you know, they're both to blame. And you actually build a very important argument around, no, they're not both to blame, that there is an oppressive machine operating here in response to journalists trying to tell the truth about what's going on. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit more deeply. You've begun talking about it, and then go into something else that, you know, just sort of what's happening here and what's been the impact of all of this.
You know, it brings up an important point, and I think that we've seen kind of an evolution over the past 2 weeks with these protests. On the first couple nights of these protests, we were seeing a lot of the media coverage was about not the overwhelmingly peaceful protesters, but kind of the random looters that kind of emerged from this. the coverage was still at that point kind of tilted towards the police. But what ended up happening was, you know, all of these videos of all of these protests started emerging. I mean, it's quite ironic that this is a protest that started about police brutality, and the police responded by acting even more brutal to a huge segment of the population. And, you know, you can only watch so many videos of protesters marching calmly and not engaging in any violence, and then seeing the police charge at them and hit them with batons, or, you know, spray people in the face with pepper spray when they're laying on the ground defenseless. You can only watch so many of these videos until you realize that the story that we may have been told was just not true, that this isn't a both sides issue at all. It's an overwhelming problem on one side, and that side has been the police. You know, you can only, if you're watching CNN, for example, and you see their reporting crew standing far away from the protesters, calmly talking about what is going on, and you see police officers approach them and arrest the entire camera crew, despite the reporters calmly saying that they'll comply with police orders and that they are the media, and this is happening on live television, there's only so many times you can see that. And, you know, as depressing as a lot of these videos have been, I think the one takeaway here is that it's been heartening to see public opinion switch as all of this evidence of what everybody has been saying has been happening for so long has come forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about this point about generating international outrage, because so many people actually from other countries have also been impacted by this. They've actually been thrown down on by the police in relation to all this. This is something that a lot of people don't even recognize. And I think it's important for people to know that there's this kind of thing going on, even as we're talking about just, you know, we can't talk about just what's happened to people in the press here and leave aside the idea that, or the understanding that there's been a lot of outrage that has been directed at people from other countries. And that's actually, and well, let's go on with that.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, over the past several years, there's been an increasing worry among the press freedom community that governments around the world have been engaged in crackdowns against journalists for reporting on things that their governments just didn't like. And in the past, the U.S., while they've had a very spotty, to say the least, record on press freedom, you know, we are still the country with the First Amendment, and we've been able to pressure governments in some cases, even if it was hypocritically, to improve conditions for journalists. But what we've seen over the past couple weeks has really kind of torn down any opportunity for the U.S. to do that in the future. And it's actually happened to foreign journalists who are here in the United States covering these issues. I mean, these George Floyd protests are not just a national thing. They are being covered extensively all over the world. And so different countries, like from Germany and from Australia, has sent reporting crews here to capture all of this. And in many cases, those journalists, too, have been attacked by police. You know, there was a rather famous incident in D.C. with federal police, where an Australian news crew was just sitting on the side of a protest wearing vests that said press on them and had giant cameras that showed everybody clearly they were just there documenting and not protesting. And they were essentially beaten up by federal authorities on camera. And this was actually live on Australian TV at the time. And so the Australian government was furious about this and actually made an official complaint to the Trump administration and the State Department. And actually, thanks to their complaint, the police responsible were at least put on leave pending an investigation. And the United States was forced to issue a statement of apology because of this. But it's happened to many foreign journalists. There was another crew from Germany that the same thing happened to. Journalists from several countries have been hit by rubber bullets. So it is really painting a real black eye around the world when we're talking about police conduct in the United States.
Yeah, it's really important. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to get into, too, is that this is all backed by data. This is not just sort of a question of, well, your opinion versus my opinion. You know, this is actually backed by data. And I think a lot of people don't even understand what is happening. What are the police doing out there? What are they doing to both people who protest, to people who stand up and say, no, we're not going to, especially in this kind of atmosphere right now. And also at the same time, the kind of, you know, going out against the people from other countries, and they're actually saying, wait a minute, this is major news. What's happening in terms of what the U.S. is doing to people, and it's this attempted distort and cover up that really struck me very heavily. There's this idea that there's a tendency to say that the police and protesters are equally responsible to the situation, and when actually everything that, and you make this point that everything that they try to argue along these lines is just another extension of the lies that they're telling from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I would emphasize that fact as well. Like all of this data that I'm sharing now, this is not just random anecdotes, and this is not just something that we have started collecting in the past few weeks. We at Freedom of the Press Foundation and the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker have been doing this for years. And it's not just about protest. What we were trying to do initially was to fully understand the state of press freedom in the United States. So we're not just taking, kind of random things that people say on social media and counting necessarily everything that comes across our wire. We actually have a team of reporters who goes out, and when they see evidence that a potential attack has occurred, they verify this information by talking to the journalists involved, by talking to witnesses, viewing all the evidence. We actually write up a full report for each of these press freedom violations so that there is kind of a canonical public record for all of this. And our kind of methodology is we are gathering attacks on journalists from all parties. So whether it's police or private citizens or government officials, we are collecting all of this data in one place so we can actually make these comparisons in a sort of a much more scientific way than just kind of using anecdotes. And so what we have found collecting all of that data from all these different sources is that it is true that police are responsible for the overwhelming majority of these attacks against journalists. And it's clearly a giant problem that is almost unprecedented in at least modern American history.
Mm-hmm. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Trevor Timm. Trevor is the executive director of Freedom of the Press Foundation. He's also a co-founder of the Stand With Reality campaign, which is raising money for Winner's legal defense and awareness about the Espionage Act's use against the sources of journalists. Let's just jump into that a little bit further, because that's exactly where I was going to take this. We're actually witnessing a truly unprecedented attack on press freedom in the United States. This is a fairly heavy thing to happen, and it's a fact now. It's not just if it could happen or whatever, that there's actually, you have the attacks, some attacks coming from private citizens you have, but mostly from the cops, and that is a particular basis for concern. It's a particular cause for concern. And when you look at that, there's this, this unprecedented attack on press freedom in the United States is a fact. Police violently attacking journalists at the rate of 4-1 compared to attacks on private citizens and out of control militarization of the police. What's it look like to you, man?
I think this, while the attacks and the scale of the attacks have been, literally orders of magnitude larger than we've ever seen, this powder keg has essentially been sitting there and waiting to explode like this for several years. And you could probably argue 2 decades, ever since kind of the post 9/11 militarization of the police, where the Defense Department literally gives military equipment to police departments around the country. And not just in big cities, but often in small towns. They're driving around in tanks, they're carrying assault rifles, they're dressed in full riot gear. And this is the type of behavior by police that escalates normally peaceful situations instead of de-escalating them, which is what they should be doing. I mean, I think we've seen so many videos. I mean, the most famous for the past 2 weeks has been the peaceful protesters in Lafayette Park in D.C. when Trump wanted to cross the street to do a photo op. And there was these entirely peaceful protesters, some of them Catholic priests from the church in the surrounding area, who were just sitting there, and they ended up getting bombarded with tear gas and pepper balls. And the police unilaterally caused, actually in this case, it was partly federal troops who caused this mayhem. And this militarization of police has contributed to this systematic problem, where police see it as their duty to treat anybody who is not police in these situations as the enemy. And so if you're in that situation and you're a journalist who's only there to witness and document something, then you end up becoming a target too, because the police obviously understands that anytime any of this is filmed, there is at least a little bit greater chance of accountability coming to them. And so they don't want anybody videotaping it either. And so it has caused them to specifically target journalists too. But, you know, it's even though the scale has been so big this past week, you know, this has been an issue for quite some time. You know, you can think back to the Ferguson protests in 2014, also about another black man killed by police. And that time it was Michael Brown. And there was at least 15 journalists arrested in Ferguson. They also had tear gas and rubber bullets shot at them then. You can go back to the Occupy protests in 2011 in New York, where the NYPD arrested about two dozen journalists. And so, you know, there's been moments in recent history where, in at least single cities, where we've had kind of this problem flare up, where police are targeting journalists. But we've never seen it on this type of scale, where it's city after city nationwide, where police seemingly are doing the same thing, kind of shooting journalists with rubber bullets, tear gassing them, pepper spraying them, and arresting them, when they have a constitutional right to be there and document this all.
Basically, as I'm listening to you, I think it's really important, the stuff that you're saying, but it also drove home to me, or it drives home to me, the reality that you're talking about, this actual out-of-control militarization of the police and the attacks on private citizens that are actually happening. And what's it mean? You know, because this is a very heavy situation when you're looking at a massive police force that exists across this country that extends its tentacles out across the world. And this is what's actually happening, this militarization that is going to mean. I mean, this is a huge development in the reality of the U.S. and what it does here and to people around the world.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, I think also the attacks on journalists are kind of a microcosm for everything that has been happening to black men and women across the country, but also just anybody who has been protesting the last 15 weeks. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of videos of just outrageous police aggression against not just peaceful protesters on the street, but bystanders who are just there, who just happen to be there, commuters who are passing through the area, medics, legal observers. This isn't, you know, just happening to journalists. I think it ends up, at least in the public consciousness, being particularly egregious because the journalists are quite literally saying, we are just here to document this. We're just here as a way for the public to find out what is going on. But it's really happened to everybody. And the videos that everybody has seen on social media that have, you know, hundreds of millions of views at this point are really shocking to watch. And I think it has, you know, the police brutality has been on the minds of, you know, a significant portion of the public for many years. But I think there is a lot of people in the U.S. that either just ignored it or thought maybe people were exaggerating or didn't think it was an issue that they needed to care about. But just seeing these videos over and over and over again, all of them different, but all of them kind of having the same theme of just poor, innocent people being beaten, sometimes within an inch of their life, it can have a powerful effect. And we've seen that in public opinion just in the past week. You know, states are now scrambling to figure out how to reform police departments when they've resisted it for years. So from that perspective, you know, these protests, I hope that they're nowhere close from over and there's a lot more action to be taken. But from that perspective, I think that they've already been a success because they've shown they have forced local governments to act where in the past they have refused.
Let me ask you this one last question, and you've kind of spoken to it, but I want to see if there's any more you want to say to it. Let's circle back to the importance of recognizing what is happening now. I think it's really important that people don't just get to sit back and say, okay, well, we heard this discussion. What's the actual importance of recognizing what's happening now in particular?
Well, you know, I there was a news article just yesterday, I believe, that looked at how large these protests were. And they are quite literally the largest protests in recorded American history, at least in modern history, where we've been able to at least document these things with video. They virtually overnight, these protests spread from Minneapolis to every major city in the country. And every major city in the country has had problems with police aggression in the past. And the protests just highlighted that it's getting even worse. And the large swaths of the population who have joined these protests and have, you know, made it clear to elected officials that this is a huge problem in the United States has virtually overnight made politicians terrified that they need to do something or they will continue and potentially get even bigger. And, you know, I think a lot of people in the United States can sometimes get pessimistic. And, you know, I include myself into this. I think everybody feels this way, that politicians never respond to the needs of the people and that, you know, it's kind of hopeless because politicians are controlled by big moneyed interests and don't look out for the little guy. But I think the American people have shown what large protest actions like the ones we've been seeing can have a huge effect if everybody comes together and is focused. And it's been, you know, on the one hand, it's been terrifying to see all of the horrible things that have happened. But on the other hand, it's been inspiring to see that so many people from so many different walks of life are willing to take those risks and have taken those risks and are now already seeing the benefits of doing so.
All right, Trevor, Tim, I want to thank you for joining us today.
All right. Take care.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Trevor Tim, Executive Director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. As I said at the beginning, last week we heard Bob Avakian, B.A., the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on the oppression of black people and other people of color, from the speech, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. This is part of what's called the five stops: stop genocidal persecution, mass incarceration, police brutality, and murder of black and brown peoples. Stop the patriarchal degradation, dehumanization, and subjugation of all women everywhere, and all oppression based on gender or sexual orientation. Stop wars of empire, armies of occupation, and crimes against humanity. Stop the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants and the militarization of the border. Stop capitalism, imperialism from destroying our planet. So we're going to hear two more pieces: the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants and male supremacy stitched together with capitalism. And in the coming weeks, I hope to play the other two segments in this section of the speech, the other two stops.
The demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants and the militarization of the border. The borders of this country were first established through war and repeatedly expanded through armed conquest of land, especially in wars against the native peoples and a war against Mexico in the middle of the 19th century. This war resulted in over half the territory of Mexico coming under the control of the U.S., and it was fought on the U.S. side for the purpose of expanding slavery, as well as greatly enlarging its territory. Since the end of the 19th century, the U.S. empire has been expanded not only by seizing countries such as the Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Guam, as colonies or near colonies, but also through invasions and other means, installing rulers dependent on and obedient to the U.S. Today, the U.S. has military forces and intelligence operatives stationed in over 100 countries around the world, and it provides military backing and other aid to governments, including brutally oppressive regimes that it maintains as part of the U.S. empire. And relying on its military, as well as its economic power as coercion, U.S. imperialism not only continues to politically dominate, but to economically exploit and plunder countries throughout the Third World. Again, the countries of Latin America, and in particular Mexico, El Salvador, and other parts of Central America and the Caribbean, which the imperialists of the U.S. arrogantly regard as their backyard, have been the special targets of all this. Not only has the U.S. repeatedly carried out military invasions and coups there and backed murderous dictatorships with their bloodthirsty death squads terrorizing the people, but it has imposed economic agreements that have further bled these countries and intensified the misery of the masses of people there. For example, contrary to the lies spouted by Donald Trump, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, engineered under Bill Clinton's presidency, has not resulted in the U.S. getting screwed, but has actually resulted in the ruin of large numbers of farmers in Mexico and increased the number of desperately poor people there, which has been a major factor in driving many people from Mexico to the United States. Trump only wants to make all this even worse. For all these reasons, along with other factors such as global warming and the accompanying crisis of water shortage in many countries, there are tens of millions of refugees in the world today, driven from their home countries and seeking asylum or simply a means to survive in the U.S. and in capitalist countries in Europe. And given all this, it is the height of hypocrisy and of cruelty for the U.S. government, and in particular the Trump-Pence regime, to talk about the right of countries to secure their borders and bray about building a wall to enforce this, let alone to denounce the masses of immigrants from a country like Mexico as rapists, drug dealers, and murderers, and to enact such barbaric measures as separating children, even very young children, from their parents if they are attempting to enter the U.S. without the required papers, and even if they are seeking asylum from persecution and violence. Here again, while determined and massive struggle needs to be waged against these inhuman actions by the U.S. and other oppressive governments, it should be clear that there can be no solution under the system of capitalism imperialism to the situation involving masses of immigrants and refugees. The only solution lies in the revolution to overthrow this system. A revolution aiming not just to abolish oppression, exploitation, poverty, and misery in one country, but having as its fundamental goal the abolition of all this throughout the world and the elimination of all borders and boundaries that erect walls between the different parts of humanity.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was The Demonization, Criminalization, and Deportations of Immigrants from Bob Avakian. Now we'll hear male supremacy stitched together with capitalism.
The oppression of women and oppressive gender relations. Not only is white supremacy completely interwoven and tightly stitched together with the development of capitalism in this country, but male supremacy is also completely interwoven and tightly stitched together with the whole historical development of the division between exploiters and exploited, oppressors and oppressed throughout the world, including the capitalist imperialist system, which is dominant in the world today. Thousands of years ago, with the development of human societies in such a way that means of production, land, domesticated animals, tools, and so on, were no longer the common resource of people, but instead became privately owned. And with the division of labor resulting in women being responsible for child rearing and men dominating ownership of these means of production and wanting to pass this along to their male heirs and not someone else's, this led to the dominance of the patriarchal family, with the man having power over his wife or wives and children, and women in society overall being subordinate to men, with all the brutality and terror, both mental and physical, that has been used to enforce this, and the whole ideology and culture of male supremacy and misogyny, regarding women as lesser, despised beings whose essential purpose is to serve men, that has rationalized and reinforced this inequality and oppression. This patriarchal oppression has also been bound up with the suppression and punishment of relations among people, including intimate relations, that run counter to and challenge traditional gender relations. It is crucial that there be determined struggle against this terrible oppression in all of its manifestations. But in order to finally abolish and move beyond all this, in society as a whole, and not just in one country, but for all of humanity, it is necessary to abolish the private ownership of the means of production, converting them into the common property of the people as a whole, and to replace the traditional patriarchal family with relations among people, including intimate relations, that are freely entered into and freed from all vestiges of oppression. This, of course, is impossible under capitalism. Only through the revolution to overthrow this system and uproot all relations of exploitation and oppression that are embodied in this system will it be possible to finally end the fundamental division in which half of humanity is subordinated to and dominated by the other half, and all the brutality and agony bound up with that. This is why, in the new socialist society that will be brought into being with the overthrow of capitalism, the goal, as set forth in the Constitution for the new socialist republic in North America, must be to overcome all traditions chains embodied in traditional gender roles and divisions, and all the oppressive relations bound up with this in every sphere of society, and to enable women as fully as men to take part in and contribute to every aspect of the struggle to transform society and the world in order to uproot and abolish all relations of oppression and exploitation and emancipate humanity as a whole.
That was Bob Avakian, leader of the revolution, author and architect of the new communism, from the speech Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And that was the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants and male supremacy stitched together with capitalism. You can find videos of the whole speech and the question and answers and much more at revcom.us. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Coco Das from Refuse Fascism and Trevor Tim of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, and of course, Bob Avakian. I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to share your thoughts and ideas about the show, or if you want to volunteer to be part of the show, write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.